Outdoors coming on the airwaves, coming your way.
Hey now, we're outside indoors, beat on a buck on a snowy day.
Hey now, we're inside outdoors, baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Inside Outdoors is brought to you from the beautiful rolling hills, forests, and lakes of southern Indiana. Produced in Bloomington and brought to you live every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. Inside Outdoors features hosts Don Jordan, Buddy Bill Moser, and Rich Reardon, and gives you everything you need to know about the outdoors surrounding our local community, our state, and around our nation. With fishing, hunting, local and national outdoor news, the environment, natural resources, safety, issues in our community, and just down-home family fun, our goal is to inspire how to be a good steward of our precious natural resources. You can call into our show at 812-323-1200 and ask a question or tell us what's on your mind. So sit right back, get a cup of coffee, journey with us into the lakes and woods, and find out what our natural resources have to offer. If you miss the show, you can listen online at WFHB.org. Just go to the public affairs listing, and you'll find a podcast of our show at Inside Outdoors. This is WFHB Bloomington, Indiana, volunteer-powered community radio at 91.3 FM for South Central Indiana, also 98.1 in Bloomington, 100.7 in Brown County, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org.
Hey, good morning, everybody. It's Inside Outdoors, and I'm Don Jordan, and I'm here today with...
Hey, it's Rich Reardon.
And Alan Bronenberg.
Good morning, fellas.
How you guys doing?
Hey.
Everything going okay out in your territory? You got any snow left on the ground?
Just on the deck. And it's pretty frosty out there on the north side.
Man, it was frosty on Wednesday morning, I'll tell you that.
It sure was.
Yeah.
Frost was on the pumpkin. And funny thing is that just a week before, people were catching fish like crazy down at Lake Monroe.
Yep.
The week before.
Well, I've seen a few bass come through, and which was kind of unusual this time of year, because we have now, let me see if I got my notes open here. It is lake levels 538, which is normal, and we are at, well, they say 63.14, but last week I said I think it was more like 55. So I'm guessing it's even colder than that now.
I would imagine they
haven't updated it.
Yeah, I got to believe it. It's much colder than 63 in the water. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's probably 50 or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, that's good crappie fishing. I don't know whether you saw that big bag of crappies that guy posted. It's on Inside Outdoors on Facebook.
The tails?
They were cleaned.
Yeah.
He uses the old scaling method.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Grandma prefers.
Yeah, a few of them.
And there's lots of people that like to leave that skin on it. It does give them a different taste. And if you're used to that and that's what you want, well, that's the way to clean them. That's to cut their heads off and scale them.
Yep.
Yeah, other than, a few walleye that we brought back from Canada, I think that's the only way I've ever eaten fish was put on a board, scaled, and heads chopped off and put in a frying pan that way.
Well, that used to be the case until way back in the 70s. I met Dick Dickens down there at Smithville. He had a little bait shop there.
You probably
all remember him. And he showed me how to fillet bluegills, and that's what I do now.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. You can get practically everything that you can get in taking their heads off, maybe a little more, because when you take their heads off, you miss that meat up on top,
Right.
Yep.
And so filleting bluegills is a whole different kind of taste. They're certainly easier to fry.
Had to be. they've got to be easier to eat. I mean, when I was 4 years old, I was picking the bones out of a bluegill myself, because, grandma would put the plate on the table and show me how to pick the bones out, and I learned.
Right.
Yep, that's right. There's one place I know of in this world, actually in my world, I suppose, where you can still go to the restaurant and get old-fashioned clean bluegills served in a home-style dinner.
Oh, wow.
That's down at Lake Reelfoot, Tennessee, where they bring them out on a big platter and a big platter of hush puppies and a big platter of potatoes. And, you know, it's your classic Lake Reelfoot meal.
Taking me back, I'll tell you, taking me back about 60 years or 65 years even.
Yeah.
Lake Reelfoot is still that way. You know, they actually have commercial fishing for crappies on that lake.
Oh.
And so you can buy them at the restaurants around there.
I'll be darned.
Which is a nice little change of pace.
Must be a big lake.
It's fairly big, but, you know, it's. I think the main impetus for them doing that was to lower the crappie numbers so the bluegills wouldn't have so much competition.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a bluegill lake that has been known as a bluegill lake for decades and decades, going way back. So I can remember cleaning hundreds of bluegills caught in that lake. Yeah. Hundreds. And, you know, they're all set up for it. There's resorts all around. If you've never been to Lake Reelfoot, it's a good place to go just to see something different. It's all cypress trees.
Oh, man.
Cypress knees. And of course, that's the lake that was formed by the retrograde flow of the Mississippi River during the earthquake.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about now. Yeah.
The St. Something Fault.
Yeah.
Down there. I can't think of the name of it right offhand, of course. But that filled up the land drop. The water rushed in there. And then the land rose and cut the lake off from the river. And it's been there ever since.
Well, saved the Army Corps of Engineers a lot of money, didn't it?
Yeah, it sure did. Saved us a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it made a pretty good income spot for an area of Tennessee which didn't have anything
previous. I was gonna say they probably needed it.
Yeah, it hasn't hurt them at all, and has kept a lot of people going over these years.
But you know, that's what lakes up north used to be when I was a kid. Was they were perch and bluegill lakes. We hardly ever caught any crappie in those waters up there when I was a kid. But you know, tons of lake perch, tons of bluegills. Yeah, I never really heard of people catching a lot of crappies till I came down here.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably more of a southern thing, although bluegills used to be a bigger thing. And the reservoirs have really brought crappies into being.
They must have.
Our part of the country, because...
Why would that be done?
Well, crappies...
Do they just preferentially grow better than bluegill and...
Well, they outcompete them. The bluegill have more specific requirements about where they want to nest and where they want to eat.
Right.
And you know, let's face it, the crappies come in and eat the baby bluegills.
Yeah.
Sure.
They spawn before the bluegills do, so they're just sitting there waiting for the bluegills to spawn, and boom, here they come.
Wow.
And well, it happens to all these reservoirs. I mean, Lake Monroe, you may remember or not, I don't know, back in the 70s, again, there was really good bluegill fishing at Monroe. You could easily get a lot of eight-inch bluegills.
Yeah.
And not so much anymore.
No.
But that's the way she goes. If you want a big bluegill, you got to have your own farm pond. Keep everybody from taking out your flathead catfish and largemouth bass.
Right.
Well... In the mid-60s to the mid-70s, when we had a cottage on Sweetwater Lake, we caught the state's biggest bluegill out of there 2 years. Right after they dammed that place up, that old pond out there had a lot of old fish in it. And when they dammed it up and water raised, there's a lot of for them to eat. And, of course, they were scattered out. But we're talking 22, 24-ounce, you know, bluegills out of there that were huge. Right. I mean, just huge fish.
Pound and a half.
Yep.
Pretty good bluegill.
Yep.
I know the current and still state record red ear came out of one of those lakes over there. It might have been Sweetwater.
Yeah.
That was a guy named Bill Peckham. And he put that in a cooler and brought it over to me at the Herald Times when I was working down there. And, we took it down to Buddy Bill's, and Buddy Bill had an official meat well, you scale.
Yeah.
And it was registered and all that, calibrated. Yeah. We weighed it down there, and it weighed 3 pounds and 10 ounces.
Oh, my God.
It was a hog. It was one of those little, you know, those styrofoam coolers you buy cheap. It was sitting on ice, and it touched on top of the ice there. It touched every side of that cooler.
Oh, man. That was a fish.
Well, there hasn't been beaten since then, so.
Yeah.
You know, it's truly a major miracle. The world record is way over that. It's on the front page of my website, a picture of that. But it's not even, our fish wasn't even close to it. But still, you know, 3 pounds, 10 ounces, I'll take one of those.
Yeah.
Those are big fish.
Yeah.
Big fish.
Fun to catch a brim, bluegill. That size, the way they really bend your pole, and they don't give up easy.
They feel like a rock coming up out of the water.
Oh, they're fighters, that's for sure. They're fighters, and they have a big heart, as they say. Until we cut the heart out and eat them.
There you go.
Sorry, boys.
So much for that.
Yeah.
Hey, I was out looking at ammo this week, and just in case anybody's running low, I know there's been a giant shortage of this. I was at Rural King. They had cases of 20-gauge and 12-gauge, both shot and hard lead slugs, cases and cases of them. And I haven't seen that much ammo, and I can't tell you when. So it was Monday? Yeah, I guess it was Monday I was in there, and they had quite a bit. So anybody's running low, your local place doesn't have it. I don't know how long that'll last out there, but there was quite a bit.
And where was that again?
Rural King in Bloomington. Yeah.
Well, you know, Walmart got out of the firearms business.
Yeah.
Just here recently. They don't even sell ammo down there anymore. And
that's pretty shocking.
Well,
a little surprising.
They did it other places before they did it here, which is, you know, I don't know. But
test markets.
I'm not sure what's going on. I can't imagine Walmart deciding not to make that extra money, but you know, maybe the pressure was on them socially or something. I don't know.
I promise you, it was something that somebody thought through at the highest level. When I was in the pharmaceutical industry, I used to call on Walmart. They are they don't do anything by accident, and they are a vicious, predatory bunch of
business they
people.
Are. Yes, they are. They certainly. I just saw some stats the other day that the world's the richest family in the world is the Walton family.
Sure they are.
And by far, not the Saudi royal family isn't even in the ballpark.
No.
They are rich.
I think all the mom and pop hardware stores, lumber stores, and five and dimes that were put out of business nationwide so that 8 people could be the richest family in the world.
Yes, it is astounding, really. If you go to one of my favorite little towns in Wisconsin, Hayward, Wisconsin, I don't know whether you've ever heard of it or not, but that's the muskie capital of the United States.
Okay, there you go.
It has the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame is there, and it's at And where was I?
Yeah, they're little hardware stores and lumber stores. And
oh, yeah. They put in a small Walmart there, you know, like the one they have in Spencer.
Yeah.
And within 2 years after they opened that store, the downtown hardware store, which was owned by a friend of mine and his wife, was out of business. Had been there for 70 some years.
Damn.
And so, you know, that's just one casualty.
Yeah.
That's just one place. And that place supported 4 or 5 people.
Sure it did.
Families. And so we know that happened everywhere. I don't know how I do know how Kleindorfer's has managed to avoid that. They just have everything and they know where it is and they can help you do whatever you want to do with it.
Yeah.
Well, the mom and pop store also is nice because you don't have to park and walk like a mile before you even get to the counter to find out it doesn't exist there, even though it was online.
Yeah.
So you know, I have no, I went in there looking for, at Walmart, I went in there looking for a robe, a man's robe. And they did not have one. And the lady looked at me like I'm crazy. I was like, I mean, you have a menswear department. Why wouldn't you have a robe?
Well, that's a good question.
But they might.
Go ahead.
You know, all these businesses have, this was especially true in New York. A lot of these businesses that make it through this kind of competition all have one thing in common, and that's they own their own building. If you were paying rent, they'd already be out of business.
Yeah.
Kleindorfer's, anybody else. Kleindorfer's most likely had their inventory paid off a long time ago. I know they had tremendous buying power because of the volume of hardware that they put through there. So they had some things that set up for them that, you know, make them really unique in terms of survivability for the competition that Lowe's, Menards, Rural King, and Walmart put out for them on the same side of town. So it's a small miracle that they're still in business, but they had those things going for them. If you don't have those things going for you, there's no way you're going to make it through there.
Yes, I go in there whenever I need anything, actually. Yep. I was just in there a couple of weeks ago looking for a piece of stovepipe. Of course, you couldn't buy those anyplace else, at least not in these. All the other big stores have pre-cut links.
Sure. Right?
At Kleindorfer's, you get the piece of pipe you want, and then they take it back in the back room and cut it to the length you want.
Sure. Cut it and crimp it. Yeah.
That's right. And no charge. No charge.
And it's
plus,
not.
They give great calendar.
Yeah.
Every
year. I was thinking about that yesterday when I was driving through town. It's got to be Kleindorfer calendar time.
Yes, they said the 1st of December, so
yeah.
Probably ought to get over there before they're all gone.
We probably should.
Well, and one of our sponsors for many, many years was Morrison's, and of course they're gone now,
yeah.
But
yeah,
that wasn't because of Walmart, because they did very well. They had a great team of service people. They really did great work, and they own their own business, own their own building, like you were saying, and that goes a long way. It really does. But people get used to that kind of service, and they'll pay a little more for it. You were just talking about, Walmart, you can, or any big box store, you got like a 17-year-old, they don't understand hardware. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you go into, somewhere that's local, you're going to find people that have been in the business for 50 years and know everything about it. And that's really the, we've said this for many years on this show, but buy local if you can, because start there. It also keeps the dollars in this community. It's not going to, Arkansas,
yeah,
or worse,
Well, if you've got a daughter or a son living somewhere, and they have to make the usual repairs on their apartment or their home or wherever they're at, you find a place like Kleindorfer's, you can walk in and say, here's what I got. It doesn't work. I think I need this. If you walked into a Lowe's or a Menards, or Walmart, you could look all day. You could buy three things, make two or three trips before you got the right thing that you needed, and you still don't know how to put it on. Kleindorfer's, you can walk in and they'll look at you and they'll go, you may need this, but what I really think you need is this. And when you get ready to do this, you got to pull this little doodad out, take a screwdriver and pull this off, put this on first, and then put the screw on, and it should work. You're not going to get that at Lowe's, Menards, Walmart, any place like that. And I mean, God only knows what will happen to, that group of kids who've never been around to watch their grandfather or their father fix those things on their own. I don't know how that'll work.
Well, it's the same thing for the bait shops. We used to have 19 of them around the lake, as Buddy Bill used to like to say. And,
is that right? 19 bait shops around the lake?
There was 19 in the 60s.
Oh, my. And I had no idea.
Yeah, and now there's one. And,
yes.
And since Bill's not really doing it anymore. But, you know, the beauty of those places, you'd go in there, they had a bench out at the liar's bench outside, and you could talk about fishing, and, you know, they had everything right there. You're right by the lake, and people would congregate there, and you can't do that at, you know, at a big box store. It's just not happening.
Well, here's a mind-bending one for you. Back in the day, you know, when you're talking about right now, there were at least three bait shops inside the city of Bloomington. There was Lou's Bait Shop down on the south side, Louis Lovato. I don't know whether you guys remember him or not. And there was one on Maple up on the west side, which I can't remember that fellow's name, but it was there for years in his basement. You know, you pull up and walk in through the downstairs garage to his bait shop. And anyway, that's long gone now. And where you used to be able to stop by and get some minnows, you don't anymore. Yeah. You got to go to Sheds down at Monroe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There may be another one over by the Point. I'm not sure.
There might be somewhere you can buy a little bait, but you're not going to get the full treatment, you know?
Yeah.
The only place I really know that, you know, besides Sheds is clear over at Cataract Lake.
Mm-hmm.
You can still buy minnows by the bucket and get yourself an aerator and keep them overnight so you go fishing the next day.
Well, and, you know, the other thing is we were talking about, you know, gizzard shad and other things that show up in the lake, and it's partially because you can't get, you know, they're bringing what they can get for bait and stuff, you know, and so there's more to it than just, you know, that particular bait shop having their own livelihood. It really can help the life of the lake too, you know?
Sure. Well, a lot of those fellows you're talking about there have seines, and there's a lot of people who still seine the little streams to get their minnows, mm-hmm. to get their bait.
Yep.
And when you seine a stream, there's no telling what you're going to get. You're going to have a number of different kinds of species in there. And
right.
That's no doubt. That's probably one route that the shad have used in the past. Although with shad, you're always suspicious that the bass busters have been out there wanting to have thread fin shad so they could get big bass, not realizing that we don't have thread fin shad here.
Yeah.
And they put in those big gizzard shad. And,
yep.
Well, that was the end of that. So much. Yes, sir.
Well, hey,
Go ahead.
Did you, I assume you saw the note in come through on the news the other day in Minnesota, the guy who shot another hunter thinking he was a deer.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just that made the national news. I didn't see that locally. I did see it locally, but, and on one of the DNR sites, but I saw that on the national news.
But the crux of the biscuit with that one was he was wearing no orange. He had camouflage on, and you know, it's just, It was not the most brilliant thing that he was doing, you know, sneaking around in the woods during hunting season with camouflage on. It's not.
Was that a firearms accident?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the bow season was still going here. I saw some guys out here last week, and they don't have to wear orange in bow hunting.
Is that right?
I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
And none of them do. Of course, the deer can't tell the difference between Hunter Orange and Hunter Brown.
Right.
I was going to say, and, you know, the scent is a good giveaway anyway. Forget the color of clothes. I mean.
Well, if you're up in a tree, that's not so much of a worry. You just have to be quiet. You know, they hear everything. They have their ears just little radar boys. And speaking of that guy getting shot, a few years back, you know, I used to live in Wisconsin, so I hear a lot of news from up there. They have the opening day of deer season isn't like it is here. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people are out there, and they all congregate in these little towns around the northwest Wisconsin the night before and party, you know, get loaded.
Sure.
Maybe get in a fight or two. Yeah, it's interesting. Then they go out the next morning, you know, at their hangovers, and they have drives. They'll line up their party, maybe 10, 12 guys.
Right.
The hunting lodge. And they just walk through the woods, pressing the deer towards the next road or whatever, where they've set up two or three guys with rifles to shoot these deer that they're driving.
Yeah.
It just so happened that one of the, during one of those drives, one year, these guys are all in orange, by the way, head to toe in orange.
Yeah.
A guy in a tree stand shot and killed another hunter.
Oh,
and he had known, he knew this other hunter, and they had been in an argument at the bar the night before. And it turns out that the guy, the dead guy, had been bird dogging the shooter's wife. So there's sometimes more to these hunting accidents than you might suppose.
Right, exactly.
I'm sure it was just a natural mistake, Don.
Absolutely. He looked like a deer to me. I could have sworn he had horns.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's really good.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Hey, what could go wrong? You get to a little town full of a bunch of guys drinking with firearms. What could possibly go wrong?
Oh, nothing, of course. Well, you know, they never brought charges against the guy. And, you know, I guess they figured, well, you know, he asked for it.
Yeah,
he got it.
You know, that's what you call a very successful argument ender.
Boy, it's unfortunate. We wouldn't want to get a thing like that started as a trend.
Oh, man.
You know, it would not be good.
You know, our neighbors had a Great Dane here for years. And, you know, in the fall, they'd put this giant orange bib on it so it wouldn't get shot out in the,
right.
in the woods. I mean, it literally was the size of a deer. And, you know, I still can see that Great Dane going through the woods with that orange on. Like, well, there goes Ralph through the woods, you know.
Always a good idea these days to, especially if you're out there during deer season, to put some orange on your dog. Now, back when I still hunted quail with my buddy over in Worthington, Indiana, we would quit. We, you know, the regular season would be 2 weeks. You know, the upland season would start 2 weeks ahead, so that'd give us 2 weeks in the field before the deer boys came in with their guns. And we would just quit until the deer season was over, and then we'd start hunting again.
Yeah.
It's just too dangerous to be out there with your dog, especially.
It really is.
You're going to maybe attract the wrong kind of attention.
Yep.
Speaking of Indiana deer harvest, men, I have right here in front of me the Indiana DNR's, what do they call it, deer harvest data.
And from the last 2 weekends,
this is cumulative.
Oh, okay.
For the season, I go through this every year now. It seems it's kind of an interesting little thing if you want to know some numbers. Number one, they start this record keeping. What happened here? Just as I started to read it, it disappeared. Isn't that wonderful? Okay, here we go. They started this chart in 2015, 2016, when there were a total of 124,668 deer harvested in Indiana. And that's everything. That's muzzleloaders, bow, firearms, right? Well, we bottomed out in 2018-19, when only 111,252 deer were eliminated. And last year that jumped up to 114,882. This year we're still standing, you know, we're still going, so we haven't closed it out yet. We're at 106,709, which is firearms only. So looks like we might be making a little gain. That's about as many as we had in 2016-17 on a par to that.
Yeah.
And we'll see how many deer come in with the bow hunters and the muzzle loaders. There's also a county by county map here that tells you exactly how many deer were got in each county. And that's kind of interesting. Brown County, which, you know, has a lot of deer, has had 9,218 harvested there, while Monroe County has had 9,098. So
wow,
that's Monroe County, right? We're right up there with Brown County, which is, I find, kind of amazing. Lawrence County head and shoulders above us with 13,700. Of course, there's a lot of Hoosier National Forest land in there.
Yeah.
And can you guess which county's number one? We talked about this county over and over again in the past. That'd be, wait a minute, what's going on here? VA is trying to get a hold of me. Switzerland County.
Mm.
Down on the Ohio River. It's the only county in the state, with the exception of Steuben County up in the northeast, very northeast corner of the state, that is up in the 15,000 for Steuben County, 12,000 for Switzerland County. So that's a lot of deer, if you can imagine that happening. And Crawford, Harrison County's got 16,000. How about that?
There must be a lot of counties that have zero or ones, twos, something. I mean, because you're already, the counties you've got there are, you know, probably, yes, what, north of 75,000. That's there's out of the, 96 counties or 92? Right. Wow.
This is these are check-in counts all seasons from these.
Yeah.
Of course, that's not included in that 100. You know, the 106 doesn't include all methods.
Right.
But yeah, there are some counties that are in the hundreds. Most check-in count for the most recent season in Tipton County, north of Indianapolis, is 122.
Yeah.
And Benton County, which is big farm county, maybe they got some pheasant up there, but they got 109 deer. The picture changes completely south of US 40.
Yeah.
As you might guess. Most of the good deer hunting is down in that part of the state, although that northeast corner with Noble County's got 15,000, 2,000 for this year already.
Man.
So, you know, it's that's just a little sidelight. I haven't seen any data on how many hunting licenses we sold this year. It had been dropping until, I believe, last year. It might have come back up a little bit.
Yeah.
But except for the hardcore guys, you know, the guys that really hunt, there's not too many casual deer hunters in Indiana anymore.
I would think not, and I would think there probably weren't too many young ones either.
Well, probably not, but I guess those hunter education classes are full of younger guys.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I guess the TV shows are doing their job. And let's face it, there's a lot of country people down here in southern Indiana still.
For sure.
And have that as a tradition in their families.
Yeah.
And that's what it really takes to keep hunting going.
Of course.
If you don't have that, I probably would never been a hunter if my grandpa hadn't been a hunter.
Yeah.
You know, and I had an uncle who had bird dogs, but none of us ever hunted deer because there weren't any deer when I was a kid. Zero.
Yeah, my grandparents would go out of state to hunt deer. They shot rabbits and pheasant and quail. There were always pheasant and quail tails pinned up on the,
yeah,
the headboard of the basement down in, up the cottage up there. But, you know, and there was always, you know, rabbits were big, and of course fishing was big, but I don't have a big memory of my grandparents deer hunting, because they're just, like you say, there were very few.
Well, yeah, I remember one time my dad went deer hunting. They used, the only deer hunt in Indiana that I recall ever happening, this was pretty young, I don't know, was at Crane. And you could enter a drawing, and if you got your number drawn, you could go down to Crane and hunt a deer, and just about everybody got one, of course.
Oh, wow.
There were deer on Crane.
Yeah.
There weren't any other places. You know, they were pretty much wiped out, which I saw somebody post on Facebook this morning that we have too many deer and we ought to wipe them all out. My grandparents realized how much damage they did to our corn and beans, and they took care of them. And since we never had any deer, well, okay. You know, there are people who feel that way. I don't believe I'm one of them. I'd rather, I like to see them.
Well, I think that the important thing here, which we all know about, but we have to bring up on the show every year, and that is that, you know, you people that like Bambi, they don't want you shooting them, but you there's no predators. If you let them go, it really hurts the herd. You end up with sickly and starving deer and things. So it is a way to keep things healthy and a very important thing that's happening as well.
Yes, it also keeps the insurance claims down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which the insurance companies wanted.
I'm sure they did.
They were actually pushing for this increased limit on non-antlered deer several years ago. And this year you could have gotten, besides your buck, which you can get with your regular hunting license, you could have got three more antlerless deer in Monroe County this year for a total of four.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's nothing like eliminating the females to make the population drop.
No question about that.
Which has happened. I don't see as many as I used to, although I still see some, especially here in the neighborhood, in the backyard.
Yeah.
I guess they know the safe places.
I think they do. And, we've been here for 30 years. There have been years when we typically see 20, 30 deer in the backfield back there. Now we'll see 6, 8, 10, tops.
Right.
I will say they are very healthy looking. None of them scrawny, sickly with bad looking fur. They are very nice looking deer.
Yes. You got to give it that to Hoosier land. Actually, all the Midwestern deer are pretty healthy.
Yeah.
Maybe not as big and points as those select deer they raise down in Texas, but
yeah,
we do have pretty good deer hunting here.
Well, and that brings up another article that I saw. I think you had it on your on Inside Outdoors, or at least you commented on it, Don, because that's how I saw it. But Indiana conservation officers received a call about a guy deer poaching, and of course, yeah, that's one of the problems. Oh. That we have, and I thought it was pretty interesting. He tried to give him the slip, and they had a search warrant. They found two deer that were illegally shot, and he didn't have a license, of course. He had bait for, the deer, and never checked them in, so they donated them to a family in need, which was kind of nice, and they also found methamphetamine and other drugs, and it was kind of a good day for the DNR and for all of us, because you don't want poachers that are high on methamphetamines running around in the woods.
No, it sounded like this guy was a bad actor. And my only complaint is, and always has been, that they didn't tell us the name of the guy.
No.
They didn't tell us what county it was in even. And if you want to stop this sort of thing, or at least make it, disappear a little.
Right.
You got to shine light on these people.
Yep.
If you publish their names in the newspaper or on the radio or on television and tell people what they did and what they were found guilty of, et cetera, et cetera, they're not going to be so eager next year to do the same malfeasance.
So, why they don't? I'm a little curious about that. I would think that if an arrest was made, that's public record. It would, why isn't that getting published? I'm just.
It's curious. The Indiana tendency, I guess. To do this, to protect the bad guys, and we do that in everything. If something bad happens in a big corporate factory someplace, they're going to tell you, well, there was something discharged from a factory in Kokomo or something like that, but they don't tell us their names. And it's to protect them is all you can figure. I don't know why they feel they have to be to protect these people who violate the law, but it's the case. It definitely happens and continues to.
Yep.
And, odd, terrible.
In many states, especially that northern tier states where you have, you know, everybody hunts. You know,
yeah.
Everybody hunts deer. The local DNR arrests are published in the local newspaper once a week.
Yeah, I would think so.
With the names and what they're charged with.
Yeah.
But not here.
Do you know where District 8 is?
It must be to the west of us. Why do you ask?
Well, I was looking on the DNR site and on Facebook, and they have said there's been a lot of unlicensed, you know, individuals, poached deer, drug violations, lost hunters, hunting accidents. It's apparently the worst place in the state.
I can never get these districts straight. About the time I here is District 8. Here's ICO District 8 on tweet. Oh, I see where it is. That's Clark, Crawford, Floyd, Jackson, Harrison, Lawrence, Orange, Perry, Scott, and Washington. All of them right in the middle of the southern Indiana.
Yep.
Yeah.
Down all the way down to the river. That'd be the Lawrence, the farthest one north. And then you got, of course, right along the river, they got Clark, Crawford, Floyd, Jackson. Well, Jackson is not. That's closer to us.
Right.
Harrison, Orange, that's Paoli.
Yeah.
And Perry, Scott, and Washington, those are a little bit out of that area. But Perry is right down there, you know. So those are always been hot spots for poachers because nobody ever paid any attention to them before.
Yeah, there's no population down there.
It's very sparse, and
yeah,
a lot of those old boys live back at the end of those little old dirt lanes you see going off the road, and aren't used to following anybody's rules. And,
right.
No, they've probably been living this way their whole life. You know, absolutely. It's just a random chance that they would get caught.
That's absolutely right. I know for a fact that it's a pretty common thing to keep your rifle in the kitchen, and if you see a deer in your backyard out the kitchen window, you just open the window and blast it.
There you go.
You know, that's how it works. So
sounds easy to me.
Yeah, well, I don't know how that works out in the long run.
Yeah, I don't either.
Well, just so you know, the firearms is over. It ended on November 29th for deer, and muzzle loader is coming in today, December 5th, which will be when we actually air this show, and that goes on to December 20, and then special antlerless, as you were talking about earlier, is at the end of December into very beginning of January, the 26th through the 3rd. So that'll be it for deer season for the
yes,
fall.
Yes, then we'll be into the dreaded month of February.
Yes.
Which is, you know, for an outdoor person, there's hardly a worse month. I hate to be so negative, but, you know, there's just nothing going on. It's too cold to do much, and sometimes there's a lot of snow. There's no hunting, there's no fishing, because unless you're an ice fisherman, although we haven't had any ice fishing.
Well, Don, I got something you could do.
What's that?
You could pay $44,000 and go up to Alaska and shoot a polar bear.
Yeah.
There you go.
You can do that in February.
Yeah, right. How about that?
Wasn't that horrible? I can't even believe doing that. You know, they're endangered, and I don't understand how they can even offer this.
Well, I can tell you, I know how they will argue this, is that, well, they're going to die anyway. We might as well make use of the resource.
Yeah.
That's the train of thought.
Yeah. That's what we call that, a preemptive lie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, I couldn't believe that picture of the two bears, and it's just horrible. I've never been into trophy hunting for any reason.
Well, me either, but some people are, I guess, and there's really no law against it. You just have to have that ethic. If you don't grow up with that ethic that you learned from your grandfather and your father and maybe your mom and dad or grandmother too, I know there's a lot of women hunters out there, more than you would imagine. So if you don't have that in your family, who's going to tell you what's right and wrong? Who's going to tell you that, well, it's really not good to go out and shoot this animal just because you want it on your wall? If you're not going to eat it, why kill it?
Right.
I can't imagine my grandparents, ever having done anything like that. It's just completely against, why they did it.
Yeah, I remember an incident at my grandmother's house over in Illinois. They didn't have any deer, and they had a few quail. They had quite a few rabbits. And one day, a carload of guys from Chicago came pulling up to my grandma's driveway and asked if they could hunt rabbits. And she said, sure. So they went out and bang, 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 bang. And the next day, my grandmother drove down the road, and right on the corner there, they had dumped about 15 rabbits, dead rabbits, just dumped them out on the ground right there at that corner.
Oh, my God.
They'd gone out and killed all these rabbits and just left them there. I just don't understand that kind of...
Wow.
Who is that wasteful? Who is that full of stupidity?
Yeah.
And, of course, there were never any rabbits on my grandmother's farm after that either.
Yeah.
So, bummer.
Bummer's right.
Sorry that we're such a disgusting species.
Well, the Dalai Lama says you can tell a lot about a person about the way they treat animals.
Well, I believe that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Well, the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the Dalai Lama, I got into a conversation with my cousin Ray Franklin Jordan the other day, who grew up here in Bloomington. He was neighbors with one of the Norbus.
Yeah.
And that's the Dalai Lama's family. His brother lived here. And one of his sons was in one of my anthro classes that I taught at IU back in the early 80s. And he was just a really good student, a nice guy, had everything going for him. And he was killed, hit on the highway, on Highway 1 in Florida, marching for peace.
Yeah.
Do you remember that incident?
Sure
I do.
Yeah. He ran the restaurant. What was it? Tibet, Little Tibet or something. I think he was managing that. That was his day job.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was his dad's restaurant, and he ran it.
Yeah.
I
can't think of his first name right offhand, but I remember him being in my class, and he participated. He was, great guy, great kid.
He was a lion, wasn't it?
He was what?
Wasn't it called the lion, the Tibetan lion?
It could be. Yeah, it could have been. Or the snow lion?
Snow lion, that was it.
Snow lion?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, across from Soma there.
Yeah, right next to the parking lot behind Dunkirk Square.
Right.
Right on the edge of that parking lot.
Yeah.
And anyway, that's... speaking of Tibet, et cetera, et cetera, I see that Nepal has opened up mountain climbing again. They've had a 72-month shutdown because of the COVID and the dire pollution problems they were having up on the mountains from all of the tourists dumping their waste.
They said it was just like a junkyard, like a dump. I mean, it was so deep and thick, you couldn't get through.
Yeah.
Yes. And in the spring, that all melted, and all of their poop and toilet paper and everything would run down into the town below.
Lovely.
Cover their streets. So, you can't really blame the Nepalese for that, but, they don't really have very advanced, systems for dealing with that sort of thing there.
No.
And pretty much it's on the ground.
And, wow.
They're open again. Now here they come. And the glacier is melting, going up to the mountain. So you can see in the pictures they've shown lately how it is melting. You can see how those hard edges of the glacier that you used to see are now rounded off.
Yeah.
Right. And,
looks like snow melt.
Well, that'll just cause a rush for more people to go before it all goes away.
Well, the mountain will still be there.
Yeah.
I hope. I hope. And let's see, you know, we still have a major sandhill crane migration here.
Yep.
This weather doesn't bother them at all. They probably won't move on from Jasper Pulaski or the Goose Pond for another month. At least some of them may stay all winter now. I'm not sure. Yeah. But it's possible.
Yeah. I saw a big flock chirping overhead this last week. You know, they were maybe the first time I've ever seen a flock that was a perfect V.
Oh, uh-huh.
There was no little spaces missing anywhere. It was too long, you know, narrow wings of the V with not a single bird missing. Never seen anything quite that perfect before. Usually they're, you know, kind of scattered out because there's so many of them gone.
Well, I know that if they're bucking a headwind, the first bird or two that are in the lead of that V will fall back into the protection behind the V, you know, up in that point.
Yeah.
And get a little rest, and they kind of rotate. And, you know, you move up your spot in the each arm of the V.
Fascinating.
Yeah, they're pretty good at that. And they're way up there too.
Yeah, it's got to be real cold where they're at.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And, you know, what I always like about it is you can hear them long before you see them.
Oh, yeah.
Because they make a lot of noise up there. I wonder, they're talking to each other, obviously, but yep. I wonder what they're saying.
Well, I don't know, but, you know, and the leaves are gone, so, you know, that sound just echoes through the woods that normally would be muffled by leaves, and it's pretty loud when they come through, even though they are so high.
Yes, it is amazing. And that's kind of what it's like around one of these big areas where they rest, you know, like Pulaski and Goose Marsh and Goose Pond. They make a lot of noise on the ground, especially in the mornings when they first get lively. And they, you know, they're doing their little courtship dances now.
Yep.
So you can see all of that. I mean, it's pretty amazing. It's like watching prehistoric dinosaurs out there.
Sure.
Doing their thing.
Well, and the geese and the cranes, they rely on the hot air. What do you call it? When the updrafts. Yeah. I saw a thing on PBS the other day and I guess it was in Europe where they were coming down and going into Africa on their long migration, and how they would, you know, it'd be real tough to get across the Mediterranean because they had to flap their wings as soon as you get it to a place where there's no updrafts.
Yeah.
And if they hit the water, they're done. So, you know, of course, it's a little easier over land, but the problem is when they get over water.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I also remember reading that, you know, there's a, I'm not sure what the name of it is, the crane that lives in Japan and Asia, it's got an even bigger red cap on it.
Mm-hmm.
But they routinely every year fly over the Himalayan mountains. Now, even at their lowest point, the Himalayan mountains are over 10,000 feet. So they said that some of them go over 20,000 feet. That's up there. Airplanes couldn't even go up there in the olden days, but those cranes can.
Yeah.
I don't know how they manage it. It must be pretty tough going. Of course, there's no headwind up there theoretically, but could be. I don't know.
No headwind, but probably minus 20 degrees, you know.
Oh, yeah, at least that. At least that. So
back in World War II, when they were trying to get fuel to China from, you know, going over
the hump.
The hump, yeah. They were talking, I've seen documentaries where they were talking about it took 2 gallons of fuel to get 1 gallon of fuel. to that location. And there was only one way they could go because the airplanes couldn't get over the Himalayas except in one specific path where they didn't have to go quite as high.
Well, yeah.
But the birds managed to do it.
Yeah, the birds are better flyers than we are.
Well, yes, they are.
Speaking of all that, and we only got a few more minutes here, but I got something on Cyber Friday or whatever they call it, Monday, that's pretty amazing. As you may know, and maybe you don't, but I always got into, once I got a computer, was into gaming and stuff too. And but there's one thing I bought years ago that has been updated, and now you can get it through, you know, just like online real easily. And download it. Back then, it was like 10 CDs or DVDs or whatever to get it. But it was called X-Plane 9, and now it's X-Plane 11. And it's amazing. You can fly all these different airplanes, and they work. You know, it's a simulator, so that's kind of cool. But also, it has all the, you know, Google Earth or whatever, the data from satellites. So when you go, if you want to go to the Himalaya, you can find it has like almost every airport in the world, and you can go to, say, Kathmandu and then fly over and look at the, you know, the mountains and stuff and fly around in them. And it's really amazing thing. It's really fun.
Can you imagine we'd have had that as a kid?
Jeez. Oh, man. I played it for a little bit the other night, and I couldn't even, I didn't want to go to bed.
I want to go back to Kathmandu.
Hey, one last thing, because we were talking about thing. I just want to ask you guys, what is the fastest man-made object ever? What would you guess that was? We only got about 2 minutes here.
Probably some hyper bullet.
Okay, I'm not even going to have you guess. It was a large manhole cover.
A large manhole cover.
When the U.S. started doing underground nuclear testing, they put a test bomb under, and it's the famous one where the guys in the army are sitting there watching it go off.
Yeah.
And there was a 485-foot deep shaft that they put a big half-ton manhole cover on, and when it went off, they calculated the speed was more than 125,000 miles per hour.
Whoa.
Which is five times the escape velocity of Earth, and it just went straight. They couldn't ever find it, so it went straight off, and they're thinking maybe it's around Pluto now, so we got a manhole cover floating out there somewhere.
Made in Neenah, Wisconsin. That's where they call it.
Neenah, Wisconsin. There you go.
And hey,
I'm sure it was one of those, hold my beer, I'm going to go put a manhole cover on this.
Right. Watch this.
Watch this.
Well, thanks, guys, for being here, and we'll be back next week. I hope you enjoyed the show, everybody, and we're about done now.
Have a good week, guys.
All right. See you, Don.
See you, guys.
All right.
See you, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Inside Outdoors comes to you from the beautiful rolling hills and green forests of southern Indiana. Thanks for listening. Inside Outdoors is brought to you each week on Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. If you happen to miss the show, you can listen online at wfhb.org. Just go to the public affairs listing and you'll find a podcast of our show.